Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Once again, my name is Clark Neely. I come to you from Idaho today to share a new concept that we're trying to develop out there. And the whole purpose of my project is to try and increase the value of winter canola. And we're trying to do that using this term that we developed, canolage. And the whole idea is to try and use winter canola as a dual-purpose crop, but not only that, that in and of itself is not a new concept, but we're trying to use it as a true biennial rather than a winter annual. Usually when you think of canola, first thing that comes to mind is canola oil, or used for cooking oil. That oil is also very valuable for using, putting it in biodiesel. And once you press the oil out of the seed, you get a high-value, high-protein livestock feed that's very valuable to the dairy producers out west. And in addition to that, canola has a lot of benefits rotationally, especially in our area of the Pacific Northwest, where the cropping systems are predominantly wheat, continuous wheat. So in addition to all these uses for the seed, we got our heads together, and despite all the good things about canola, it's still a marginally profitable crop, despite rotational benefits and whatnot. So we've exhausted all the ideas about trying to increase the value of the crop and the oil, so the only thing left is the forage production and what that could hold. Canola is a derivative of rapeseed, and it's been grazed for centuries in Europe, and it's also frequently grazed in Australia and other continents around the world. There is some limited data on the silage quality. However, most of that data is based on matured crops that have failed due to natural disasters or drought. Farmers just trying to get some profit out of the crop that otherwise he wasn't going to get from a seed crop. Reasons for this, one obvious reason is dual-purpose crops have the potential to increase profit for a single crop. You get multiple products for the price of establishing one crop. Also in Idaho, we're one of the fastest growing dairy states in the country, and there's also a giant demand for high quality forage. And especially now, milk prices are in the cellar for the dairy industry, so they're looking for any possible way to get additional forage on their farm for cheap. And like I mentioned before, it also offers the benefit of increased crop rotation flexibility and cover crop over the winter. Therefore, our overarching goal of this study is to increase the value of winter canola crops by harvesting both biomass and seed. And in order to do that, we need to determine accurate estimates for forage quality as well as potential yield of the canola. Also, we need to determine the impacts that that forage harvest is going to have on the following seed the next summer. So to give you a better visual representation, in our part of Idaho, northern Idaho, we typically would plant canola in the fall anywhere between mid-August to mid-September. You'd get it just big enough to make it through the winter, and then harvest the seed the next summer, around end of June, mid-July sometime. Here we would plant a winter crop in the spring. Because it needs a cold spell or vernalization, it will remain in the vegetative state all summer. You get multiple cuts on it. Then you let it vernalize, and the following crop year, you'll get the seed harvest. Our study was split plot design. We used two cultivars, canola cultivars, Athena and Balder. We used three planting densities, 6, 9, and 12 pounds per acre. And we had four planting dates. Because of time limitations, I'll restrict my speech mainly dealing with just the four planting dates, which occurred on May 15th, June 10th, July 26th, and September 1st. Give you an idea of what this crop looks like in the field. It has very lush, broad leaves. As you can see, there's no stems. Very highly digestible material. Has a pretty impressive canopy. If you let this stuff go, you can expect a canopy height of over 2 feet. This is our $2 million piece of equipment we used. we're very resourceful in Idaho. We managed to pick up that forage header at an off-station site and attach it to a 318 John Deere lawnmower. It actually did a pretty good job. We had took a 3-foot swath down the middle of the plots, had a pretty substantial bag full of forage, as you can see there, from each plot. And that's what it looks like. As you can probably see, it's pretty high in moisture content. You're usually looking anywhere between 85-90% water, which may or may not pose a problem in the field trying to dry it down. So now that you've seen what it looks like, I'll move on to production potential and quality, how this forage might compare to your more common forages that are grown in Idaho. This is a picture of our actual, or part of our study, the canola study. And during the first year in 2008, we took measurements of canopy height every week to try and give you a good idea of how this stuff reacts to cuttings throughout the summer. The green line was our first planting date. You can see it takes about 6 weeks for it to get established and high enough that we decided to take the first cut. And from there on, it only takes about a month to regrow, so we can take a second cut. We were able to take 3 cuts off the first planting date alone. Second planting date, we were able to take 2 cuts. Third planting date, 1 cut. And our fourth planting date, which was our control, we took no forage cuts. And as you can see on the yellow line, which was our third planting date, we had a little trouble establishing it, so we actually delayed the cut later in the fall. This graph shows the impact of forage versus seed yield. If you look at the dark green bars, it'll show you between planting date 1, 2, and 3 that there are significant differences in forage yield, which you would expect because on the first planting date we had 3 cuts versus 2 cuts versus 1 cut, which makes sense. And then if you look at the light colored bars, you can see our control, which was our fourth planting date in September, had the highest seed yield, followed by the first, second, and third planting dates. It is kind of interesting to note, you would think the more cuttings that you took might have a negative impact on seed yield. However, it was just the opposite. We took the most cuts off the first planting date, and that was the next highest seed yield that we got. Quality analysis. Canola is excellent in quality. It's almost considered, if you're going to feed it to dairy, you have to treat it as a concentrate. It's so highly digestible. Compared to triticale, much lower NDF-ADF values. If you're not familiar with that, NDF measures or indicates intake. ADF measures digestibility, and they have inverse relationships. So the lower the NDF and ADF, the higher the intake and digestibility, which is what dairy farmers want. Protein and canola silage is going to be higher than triticale and very, very comparable to alfalfa. When you plug that into an RFE formula, you're going to get a relative feed value that exceeds 300, which is roughly double that of alfalfa and triple that of triticale. Now you might be asking yourselves where this might fit into a cropping rotation situation. So for example, I use spring barley followed by either an establishment year of alfalfa or corn, which are commonly grown in southern Idaho. So you replace the spring barley with the first year of your winter canola, you get multiple cuts, and then the next year you get your seed harvest. And generally what we're thinking is you can get that seed off the field quick enough and still have time to plant your alfalfa, taking a minimal hit on your forage yield that first year, or maybe even come in with a short season corn. Now these values I have here are just a crude estimate of gross income. We didn't do any statistical analysis, but I used rough estimates for values of these products. And as you can see, the first planting date and second planting date were roughly the same as far as gross income are concerned, which would make sense, and followed by the third and fourth planting dates. You can't just compare those two because the first two planting dates actually take up 1.5 growing seasons, whereas the next two only take up about 1. So you throw barley in there, and those second two treatments, you can see, are slightly above the first two, But I think it's important to note that it's fairly comparable, and this isn't including expenses. In the first two planting dates, you didn't have to spend the extra money establishing that barley and getting it up and out of the ground. This was a secondary study we call the biomass study, and all we were trying to do here was just show the growth habit of the canola if you weren't to cut it. What's it going to do during the summer? Because we run out of moisture about the end of July and August. Is that plant going to die? Is it going to go dormant? Is it going to bolt? What's it going to do? So the plot on the right-hand side, we took strips down each of these rows, and the one on the left, we started on middle of June, and each week after that, we took a cut, and the far right is our control. We did not cut that at all. You can see some of the leaves on that, and right next to that was the last cut we took, which was middle of August. So we cut the plants back pretty considerably, as you can see, and they still managed to come back. Now this chart just kind of correlates with the picture you just saw in the previous slide, which was a dryland 2009. It's actually didn't make much difference between dryland and irrigated. And then in 2008, we had significantly lower values, but that could have been attributed. We had a pretty cold summer that year. We had snow in June, a frost in July, maybe heavy pest pressure. So we'll have to look at that. So in conclusion, I think the thing you should take away from this is winter canola shows tremendous resilience when you're cutting this stuff. This crop was not designed for this, but it seems to take the cuttings quite well, grows back rapidly. It's going to be a high-quality forage substitute for alfalfa or some other high-protein stock. Provides multiple products for your dairy farmer. Sustainability is a big word that's been thrown around a lot, and it should be. Here's a crop you can get a forage off of, and the seed that you get the next year. A lot of farmers are buying oil presses, and they can make their own biodiesel, and you can feed that seed meal to the dairy cattle as well. So you get three products from one crop. Also, canola does not use quite as much irrigation water, so you might conserve some water and expenses in that way. And like I mentioned before, you get variety in your cropping rotations, which we all need. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge my advising professor, Dr. Jack Brown. Dr. Carl Hunt was on my advisory committee, and Dr. Brown's field tech, Jim Davis, all helped me quite a bit. So with that, are there any questions? Yeah.
Did you feed any of the forage that was harvested?
We didn't do any trials, but as you can see here, that sheep is eating some of it. And it took them a while to get adjusted to it, but once they got used to it, they loved the stuff. It was like candy.
Did you analyze sulfur levels?
Pardon?
Did you analyze sulfur?
No, we have not gone that far yet. I do realize there's been concern in the past with sulfur levels, and we need to address that.
Yeah, how much time elapsed between your final cutting and the first frost?
I would recommend leaving at least minimum 2 weeks. I would suggest taking your last cut when you would typically want to plant the crop. So usually you want to plant the crop 2 to 3 weeks before a killing frost. So that's when I would recommend cutting it, because it takes 2 to 3 weeks to grow back a little bit in order to make it through the winter. Yeah.
What was your defoliation height, and did you see any damage from wheel tracks in your plots?
When we cut the crop, it was anywhere between 1 foot and 2 feet high. As far as damage goes, we didn't notice much, if anything. Canola is a very plastic crop, so if you kill some plants, it fills in very well. We didn't notice a whole lot, but then again, the equipment we were using were lighter. We'd have to do it in a larger scale to know if heavier equipment's going to do more damage. Oh, the residual? We left it right around 6 inches, give or take an inch. As long as the growing tip is below your cutting height, you're going to have rapid regrowth. Some of it, by the time we cut it, it doesn't bolt, but the growing tip actually gets above the soil a fair bit. And you mow that off, it doesn't kill the crop. It takes it a little bit longer to grow back, and you get multiple growing points. But and that's why I think might impact some of your seed yield. You lose that main root stem and you get a lot of branching instead.
At what height do you want to take it?
Between a foot and 2 feet, depending. Different treatments had different heights or where you were in the field.
That way you can economize the use of the forest. You don't have to cut it, but then it comes for course grazing.
About
6 inch height is a very optimum for cutting the forest.
But if the crop's going to keep growing, which it does, it would make sense to accumulate more biomass if you're going to harvest it mechanically. Maybe if you're going to graze it, yeah, you could do that, but mechanically harvesting is going to be tough to cover your expenses if you're only going to do, you're going to have to do more cuts and get less biomass. It'll be hard to harvest all that.
What about the size? If you have 1 ton green powder, when you convert it to silage,
mm-hmm.
So are the silage for 1 ton for it?
Well, I mentioned before about 85 to 90% of the crop as it's green is moisture. So, 15 to 10% of that's going to be dry matter.
And sorry, we're going to have to cut it off now.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.